Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Elizabeth Berg, who reads from and discusses her new book, Dream When You're Feeling Blue, published by Random House. In the weeks to come, we have Diana Gabaldon, Garrison Keillor, Nancy Horan, Robert Fulghum, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
A new Elizabeth Berg book is like having your favorite dessert. You take it in slowly and savor each morsel. Talk Before Sleep is a book that I absolutely cherish, having read it many times. She has also written Open House, which was an Oprah selection, among many others. In Dream When You're Feeling Blue, we meet three Irish sisters and the men they love in World War II Chicago. Please join me in giving a warm Tattered Cover welcome to the author of Dream When You're Feeling Blue, Elizabeth Berg.
Thank you so much for coming. You know those dreams where you show up naked? This isn't too far off. This I got off the plane and we raced to have something to eat, and I didn't have time to change. So I apologize for looking like the male authors. I'm just going to do this next time. It's so easy. You just, you know, sleep in your clothes and go to work. But I had this wonderful 40s dress that I got at an antique store. It was beautiful. And I packed it very carefully, and I got shoes to go with it, and I wore it a few times, and everybody was saying, oh, what a great dress. Well, it ripped really badly. I can't repair it. So, here we are.
Can everyone hear? You look like Ginsburg.
Yeah, that's what I thought. The music that was playing, I wonder if there are people here who, like me, are just crazy about 40s music. Anybody? Okay, now, who has a birthday closest to today? Anybody's birthday today? Is your birthday today? No. No? Anybody closer? Did you have your hand up for I Love 40s Music?
No, I didn't.
Okay. Disqualified. Okay. Among those who are really nuts about 40s music, whose birthday is closest today? Anybody? May? You're May? May what? 15th? 16th. Can you beat that? No. Okay. This has Glenn Miller, Louis Jourdan, Bing Crosby, Dinah Shore, Benny Goodman, Billie Holiday, and other musical veterans. Yeah.
And you're welcome.
And you'll see, too, that the same image that's on the cover of the book is on the cover of the CD, which is really nice. You're welcome. Enjoy it. So I thought I would read just from a few places, as usual, and then I'm happy to take any questions or comments, unless they have to do with fashion, in which case it's too late. Okay. So this novel, as probably many of you know, takes place during World War II, and it concerns the Heaney family. They're a big Irish Catholic family. Margaret's the mother, Frank's the father, and he's modeled after my grandfather, who was such a swell guy. My grandfather had dentures, and he used to push his lower dentures out and then gulp them back in. And I didn't know his teeth were false, so I was always trying to do that. So I thought he was very talented. Well, he was very talented. Anyway, there are three sisters who sleep in the same bed. This was an idea I took from my mom, who slept with her sisters. There were six girls in her family. Kitty is the one that we see the story. We see the story through her eyes. She's 22. Louise is 20, and Tish is 17. And they all do their part in the war effort. Margaret goes to Red Cross meetings. Frank planes spots. The kids help out with rubber and metal drives. And the girls go to USO dances, and Kitty works in a defense plant. this scene takes place after the girls have come home from the USO dance that they went to, and they're sitting around the table writing letters. I'm sure that you all know that great sacrifices were made around the table because meat, there were shortages and everything was rationed and you couldn't get meat. And, oh, that's really nice. Now we need a cat. So cooks had to be really very creative in those days. The kitchen still smelled of that night's dinner of tuna loaf, which all of them, even Margaret, had found revolting. The compensation had been that she'd made a real yellow cake with chocolate frosting for dessert, a small one, but a real one. Wednesdays and Fridays were meatless days in the Heaney house, as they were in many households across America now. Wednesdays and Fridays were also the nights Frank tried to schedule meetings of one kind or another. He had failed to find anything to do tonight, however, and had suffered through dinner with the rest of them. "Oh, it truly is awful, isn't it?" Margaret had said, and then admonished her family to eat it anyway. Billy had asked why they couldn't just have cold tuna sandwiches. "This makes my eyes water," he said. "Believe me, next time we will have sandwiches," Margaret had said. "But you've got to try new things. That's the only way you know if something's good. Imagine if Ruth Wakefield had thrown away those Toll House cookies. They were an accident, you know. Don't worry. You won't see me making this recipe again. I've given it the black X. I wouldn't feed it to a Nazi." She'd stared miserably at another bite on her fork, put it in her mouth, and spoken around it. "Although if I did, we'd probably win the war a lot faster." Now the front door opened and slammed shut, and into the kitchen came Margaret, the bun at the back of her neck slid off to the side, her cheeks flushed. "What happened to you?" Tish said. "Were you the victim again at the Red Cross meeting?" "'Tisn't the meeting I'm coming from," Margaret said, and sat at the table with her daughters. She was humming, and she had an odd light in her eyes. Louise looked up from her pages. "You said you were going to a Red Cross meeting." "I'm well aware of what I said, but that's not where I went." She got up to open the bread box. "Where's the rest of that cake?" "Billy and Pop ate it," Kitty said. "Where have you been?" Margaret turned to her daughters and spoke quietly. "Now don't be telling your father, but Maureen O'Reilly and I went to a USO dance." "What?" Tish said. "Where?" "The Catholic Center on South Wabash. I wanted to see what those dances were all about, and I did see. You girls can keep on going. It's perfectly innocent and nothing I'd ever forbid you from doing. Oh, that narrow-eyed water snake, Marnie Gunderson, and her talk about the immorality there, how she won't let her daughter go to the dances, and how I'd better go and have a look if I don't believe her. All that goes on is some lonesome soldier boys dance with some pretty girls and forget about their troubles for a while. It's lovely." "Well, I told you," Tish said, but it was all she could do to keep from wiping her brow. Good thing their mother hadn't gone to the Kelly Club, where the latest fad was the infamous dance taught to American boys by French sailors. It was called the Kiss on the Carpet, and you took turns going around a circle with a little rug, choosing a partner, and then kneeling down on the rug to kiss. Some dance. None of the sisters had taken part in that yet. But Tish kept talking about how much fun it would be and how it wouldn't hurt to try it. It wouldn't hurt to just try it. "Did you dance?" Louise asked Margaret. "Did I? And may I say, more than one young man pronounced me light on me feet and good looking to boot." Her face grew sober, and she said again, "Don't be telling your father. He wouldn't understand." From the parlor came Frank's voice. "And who would I be to deny the pleasure of your company to our fine boys?" He came into the kitchen and regarded his wife. "So long as all you did was dance. In fact, may I have the honor?" Margaret smiled, but waved him away. "Ah, come on, old doll. Don't break a man's heart." He held out his arms. Margaret walked into them, and they waltzed out of the kitchen. Just like my house. This is another little passage that refers to the menus of the time. "Stuffed beef heart last night," Frank said. "Tonight, boiled tongue. Mother of God, Margaret, can't we at least have some porcupines?" He meant the little meatballs made mostly from rice, but with bits of pork sausage and ground beef in them. "Sure, you complained enough when I made them, too." Margaret dabbed at her mouth with her napkin. "Now they would be welcome as the second coming." Margaret lay her napkin down and stood. "Here's what, Frank Heaney. I hereby resign from the position of cook. I've taken on other work now, and it's gotten too hard for me to do everything myself. You cook for the duration. You shop at the butcher and the baker and the grocer, and you juggle the points and the stamps, and you stand in the lines, and you come up with the menus. I'm sure I'll enjoy the vacation. And now, if you'll excuse me." She pushed her chair under the table, went into the parlor, and turned the radio on loudly. The family sat still, looking down into their plates, and then Frank cleared his throat and said, "Well, I'll be right back." No one could hear the brief conversation over the sound of Kate Smith, but their father returned to the table after only a minute or so. "Good news from the front," he said. "We'll have the fine services of your mother in the kitchen after all, and you're none of you to complain." "I didn't say anything," Bink said. "Just a general reminder," Frank said. "Pass me the tongue, please." This book really should have had a subtitle of Sentimental Journey, because it certainly is that. And this part is a place in the book that very much reflects that. Let me have a swig of gin here. Kitty sat out on the front porch steps in the heat of the late July evening. The family had gone to a novena together, then come back to hear FDR deliver another fireside chat. It was always soothing to imagine him sitting there in his cardigan with his cigarette holder, to hear him speak calmly and with great assurance about events that were so very frightening. Kind of like these days, huh? With Commander Guy. FDR had a way of making you feel as though he were in the room right with you, reaching over to put a steadying hand on your shoulder. People all over the country wrote to him as though he were their friend. "Take lemon for your cold, I keep telling you," one man had reportedly written him. "If you could just send us $35, wrote another. Margaret always said that next to the rosary, FDR was the best tonic for the times. Kitty liked Mrs. Roosevelt even better. She was so intelligent and so honest. Her monthly column for the Ladies' Home Journal was called If You Ask Me, and in it she had vowed to answer whatever question she was asked about anything. Sometimes the questions were about etiquette, sometimes about relationships. Once she was asked about her taste in music. She preferred classical. This month, this is a true story, this month, a woman had sent her a letter asking if soldiers from the Middle Western states, which were normally Republican, were sent into combat zones before soldiers from Democratic states. Mrs. Roosevelt began her response by saying, "I have never heard anything so idiotic as your question." Tonight, the president had announced that with the invasion of the Allies into Sicily, the first crack in the Axis had come. Hitler had abandoned the Italians in Sicily just as he had in Tunisia. More than 250,000 Axis troops were captured there. The Russian front was advancing, and the Pacific front too, with its liberators flying from Midway to continue the Japanese on Wake Island. The women were worried for their men, but they didn't speak much about it. It was their job, as the song said, to accentuate the positive. Little tolerance was given to women who behaved hysterically, to those who wrung their hands and wept over a lack of letters, or complained about their lonely Saturday nights, or the way their babies were known to their fathers only by wallet-worn photos. The president had praised the great increase in merchant shipping, saying that Tonight, we are able to terminate the rationing of coffee. Frank stood and cheered so loudly the family almost didn't hear that in a short time more sugar would also be available. What stuck most with Kitty from FDR's speech tonight was what he said about the home front. No one can draw a blue pencil down the middle of the page and call one side the fighting front and the other side the home front, for the two of them are inexorably tied together. Kitty understood this with her head and her heart and her hands, but what she wished for on this hot summer night was an instant return to normalcy. It was stifling, still up in the 80s, and humid, the air so close it felt like hands around her throat. She sat alone, trying to cool herself with a pleated fan she'd made out of newspaper, her skirt hiked indecently over her knees, her blouse open, two buttons down. The fireflies were out, and they lit on and off, regular as a heartbeat. She watched them, weary and mesmerized, and each time they lit up, there seemed to come another scene of a more innocent summer, scenes from her childhood, Pop churning strawberries into ice cream, his white shirt sleeves rolled up past his elbows, and his forehead beaded with sweat. Cabbage roses grown so large and fragrant you could smell them a block away. The plunk of the first blueberry into the silver bucket. The thrilling leap of grasshoppers in high grass baked warm and sweet-smelling by the sun. The 4th of July, babies asleep on their laid-out blankets, while above them fireworks spread across the sky like giant chrysanthemums. Margaret's canning steaming up the kitchen windows, her apron gaping at the bosom and her hair escaped from her bun in wild, wet tendrils. The scent of outside, captured in sheets pulled up to Kitty's chin by her parents before they kissed her goodnight. Kids standing out in the yard and calling, "Oh, Kitty," for her to come out and play kick the can. All of the family lying out in the backyard and wishing on stars. And what had she wished for then? A best friend who was not her sister. Free candy. The retirement of Mrs. Hornbuckle, a teacher as mean as her name suggested. All wishes so very different from what she'd wish now. And this will be the last little part. And this takes place when Kitty has gone outside to mail a letter that's kind of a secret letter to her sister, Louise's fiancé, whose name is Michael. At the mailbox, Kitty looked down at the letter in her hand. In a little while, it would be in Michael's hand. Such an amazing fact that in the midst of a war, the mail came. That a man took time from trying to kill and not be killed to read a letter about his son, how his son had learned that day to walk, how his girl lay in bed at night, longing for him. Kitty wished she could tuck herself inside an envelope every now and then and make the trip to one of the many places she and her sisters sent letters to. She imagined herself flying across some vast ocean and stepping out onto foreign soil, just an American girl, come to stand before American boys. All she wanted to do was wander around a camp, smiling at those boys, an unspoken message in her eyes. And what was the message? Gratitude, most profoundly. When she climbed the porch steps, shivering, Kitty thought about the boys who slept outside in the cold. How did they do that? She sat on the top step and looked at her watch. How long could she last out here a few steps from her own front door? But they were lying on the ground, those boys. Kitty moved over to the corner of the porch and lay down. It hurt her hip to lie this way, her shoulder. It made her dizzy to be without a pillow. So hard to imagine, in any true sense, how the boys at the front lived. They were filthy, dirty, and without any semblance of routine or familiar surroundings. They were so far away, physically, yes, but even more important, psychologically, from all the things in their life that once meant stability, that meant home. No family or old friends, no beds or chairs or kitchen tables or toothbrush stowed neatly in its holder, no walls. Instead, the men awakened in a new place, sometimes every day, and lived by instinct, like animals. Maybe, though, they were too tired to feel bad for themselves, too tired to feel much of anything. Kitty had read about the crushing kind of fatigue those soldiers endured, and still they went on, because they had to. Last August, in Sicily, the men of the 1st Division were on the front lines for 28 days straight, walking and fighting all that time. 28 days. The moon went through its phases. Kitty went to the factory and browsed at the fair store and saw movies at the Paradise with its immense staircase and statues and fountains and ceilings full of stars. She went to Fritzl's restaurant and, stuffed, pushed away a plate with good-tasting hot food still on it. She laughed and talked and slept late on the weekend and fingered the fine fabrics of the dresses she could now afford to buy. In 28 days, birthdays were celebrated and weddings were performed. Women came to term and delivered and went home with their new babies. And all the while, the men were walking and fighting, walking and fighting. No more talk about what they were going to do to those sons of bitches when they finally got over there. Now they were there. Now they were in it. And Kitty couldn't help but think that most all of those boys, those clenched-fisted, wide-eyed boys talking so boldly about teaching those Nazis a lesson, now wanted only to come home. Kitty made a pillow of her arm to keep her face from pressing against the cold floorboards of the porch. So maybe it was something like this, only with the presence of extreme danger. Did fear make you warmer? She closed her eyes, imagining that all around her were unseen enemies, and that although she needed to sleep, she also needed to stay alert. She imagined a whistling in the air, a mortar shell coming in, how she'd have to get out of the way and run. She rolled over and over as quickly as she could in her coat and galoshes and then jumped to her feet, holding in an imaginary automatic rifle. The front door opened, and there stood her father, squinting at her, clutching his bathrobe tightly around his throat. "For the love of Mike, what are you doing out here?"
"Nothing," Kitty said.
"Sure, I thought Bushman the gorilla had escaped from the Lincoln Park Zoo."
"Sorry, Pop." He looked around the porch, pushing down on his hair, which stood right up again.
"Are you all alone out here, then?"
"Yes."
"Well, come inside. 'Tis late. What were you doing out here?"
"I mailed some letters." Kitty walked past him, refraining from hugging him, which is what she wanted to do. She felt as though she'd been far away to a terrible place, and now here she was, walking into her own house, safe. The thought of her bed and her sisters upstairs made her feel like weeping.
"I'm going to have a glass of milk and a wee bit of jelly roll," Frank said. "Will you join me?"
He spoke quietly, for after dinner Margaret had given the family explicit instructions not to touch that jelly roll. She wanted to serve it again the next night.
"I will have some," Kitty said. She took off her coat and galoshes and went into the kitchen.
"We'll both be tired in the morning," Frank said, "and in a fair amount of trouble with the crossed arms missus."
Kitty said she knew. Somehow, she was honored. She sat down at the table. Frank poured them each a glass of milk and cut them not ungenerous slices of jelly roll. He clicked his glass with hers.
"Here's to my wife and great love of me life," he said.
And then, leaning in conspiratorially, "May they never meet."
Oh, he's just kidding. He tells her that, in fact.
Thank you very much for coming. I'm so glad to see you again.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for Diana Gabaldon, Garrison Keillor, Nancy Horan, Robert Fulghum, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on May 17th, 2007.